Our next session this morning will be a groundwater management scenario analysis for the High Plains Aquifer in the southern Nebraska Panhandle. Our speaker is Heath Kuntz, and Heath is with Adaptive Resources Incorporated in Colorado and in Nebraska. Heath, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you and good morning. As Mr. Smith said, I'm Heath Kuntz. I'm from Fort Morgan, Colorado. Our other office is in Scotts Bluff, Nebraska, and we have we're consultants for water resources mostly, though we do a variety of different things. This particular project was a project that we did as as consultants to the South Platte and North Platte Natural Resources Districts, both in the Panhandle of Nebraska, along with the Upper Niobrara District that is in the northern panhandle of Nebraska. We'll focus mostly on the two southerns in this presentation. The background of the modeling area is this is the Western Water Use Management Model. It's a third generation of modeling for the area. We've done two previous generations where we end up doing, kind of started with data sets and land use and then moved up to doing additional modeling over time. We created basically decision support tools for them to use for basically changes in the aquifer. They are looking at managing this aquifer as it's not a readily recharged aquifer, and they're seeing groundwater declines over time. We were using this as a decision support tool to actually set allocations by these management districts so that they are providing maximum amounts of water the districts can either, or that producers can use, either annually or over a period of two to three years. This modeling uses three separate models to encompass this entire decision support tool. It uses a surface water operations model. This applies to the North Platte only, and it simulates the prior appropriation system as we have as its Western water style water rights that are first in time, first in right. It also provides for commingled groundwater pumping. Commingling is a term we have kind of phrased that signifies a farm supply that is both in that both receives surface water diverted off rivers most of the time or natural springs, and on top of that also then is supplemented with groundwater wells. This model also provides for canal recharge estimates, and canal recharge basically is those surface water systems moving in and the recharge from the water loss and that conveyance, as most of those canals are not unlined. It also uses a regionalized soil water balance model. This basically is a model that takes into account the climate and soil characteristics of various conditions. We've simplified quite a bit that we'll go into later, but this regionalized model is kind of a baseline for how the soils work and also irrigation in the area. It does provide the crop water use, irrigation water requirement, and the groundwater only pumping. And as you can infer, that the commingled groundwater pumping is provided by the surface water model because it must account for the surface water that's being delivered to the parcels. This model uses and predicts the groundwater-only pumping for the parcels that only have well water. The last piece of this is the groundwater model itself, which is actually a mod flow program. It uses aquifer characteristics and such to basically do the timing and movement of the water through the aquifer, and then at the end of it, it gives us a response to either aquifer drawdown, saturated thickness changes, or stream flow changes. And to give a kind of a simplistic method of how these models interact with each other, the CropSim model, which is part of this regional soil water balance model, feeds into part of the state or part of the surface water model that's called State CU. That surface water model is basically fed in net irrigation requirement, and then State CU processes canal recharge irrigation. It's basically adding a bunch of irrigation components and trying to predict what the pumping would be in those commingled scenarios. CropSim provides a direct estimate of groundwater-only recharge, or groundwater only pumping and associated recharge. They both feed into ModFlow, both as a pumping file and a recharge file that then is used. ModFlow then feeds back to a what's called a state mod model, which is a surface water interaction model that operates the surface water system under the prior appropriations system. It does that through unit response functions that we've developed for each one of these ModFlow areas, and I'll show that in a little bit. Basically, it's using a very generalized hydrologic cycle. I mean, there's most of the normal things you would see, except for a couple that is basically we've added in here, which is well pumping and canal irrigation inefficiency and recharge. Those are the two that are sometimes not typically found in this, but are adapted for our Western Waterway of providing surface water irrigation to the cycle. A little bit more about background on what is a natural resources district. These are local governments established for the conservation, development, and to manage the natural resources in Nebraska. They are quasi-municipal or quasi-governmental agencies where they collect tax dollars, sometimes in the case of use tax, sometimes in the case of operating fees and such. They then are charged with managing most things to do with groundwater, including groundwater quality management, like ensuring that transfers of acres, retirements, consumptive use calculations, and even allocations, which is their ultimate goal, are being adhered to as needed. They are governed by locally elected boards, which is sometimes challenging because many of these decisions are sometimes in contradiction to statewide policy, and so they run into a lot of local issues. And many of these people are, you know, farmers and ranchers who have a vested interest in seeing their allocations or their water quantities and quality affected, and so they tend to be a very lean kind of government agency. Each entity typically is made up of multiple counties, and they're broken up via major river basins. So, for instance, in Nebraska, there is six major NRDs that cover the Platte River, which is kind of the major river that then joins into the Missouri in and about Omaha, Nebraska. There is also NRDs for some of the upper tributaries to the North Platte and then into the Republican, which my friends from Kansas here would have plenty of opinions about the Republican NRDs and their use of groundwater across state lines. A brief overview of the modeling and the data sets that we used. The modeling itself, we chose a time period of May 1953 through April of 2014 in monthly time steps. We used extensive data sets, both land use, geology, hydrology, surface water, groundwater. We used various aerial photography. We used all kinds of different high-resolution data sets, local data sets, statistic information, all kinds of things that we could basically piece together to make the data set as complete as possible. This is a partially integrated modeling, so it does feed back on itself in various situations. And so this partial integration actually helps us in calibration. It also helps us in some of these more complicated analysis. The base data is all of the crop data. It also includes parcels, irrigation types, crops, basic area information, and well information. It's done in a spatially enabled geodatabase because it is terabytes in size, because it encapsulates each and every year from 53 through current day. It's used as inputs for all three models for the land use data sets. And like I said, the sources are all over the place, as many as we could get. The land use data is annual for each one of the years. These were our aerial snapshot years, and those snapshots were actual years that we had aerial photography, and we ended up examining each one of those years and then literally drawing circles and squares around each one of the fields, trying to attribute them with the data that we were trying to model. The crop type information was most what we were interested in, but we were also looking at water sources and method of irrigation, because method is a big deal for irrigation efficiency that we were after later on. We also, in the later years, had metered pumping information, as all of the NRDs that we're currently modeling have every one of their 5,000 wells metered, and so we're able to have some great data. This is an example of what one of those aerial snapshots looked like and what we ended up doing. This started just as an aerial photograph, and then we identified sprinkler irrigated parcels. Now, you can see that these parcels are different colors, and that's actually signifying different crop types that are in those. And this is for a snapshot year of 2010. And then we also identified these flood irrigated parcels that are signified in red. These are actually are all the same crop type. And most of the irrigation type information was derived out of these circles and squares. There's very little linear move or sprinkler irrigation that isn't center pivot in this region. So if we saw a circle, we categorized it typically as sprinkler, and if we didn't, it was typically flood. We then also, as important to a regionalized soil balance, is the rangeland identification, which is all of the area that actually isn't highlighted. Outside of this land use data set, we also have a dryland irrigation data set, as dryland is one of the big key components for a regionalized model as we're doing, which is, you know, covering the entire panhandle. This is actually a much zoomed out version of the same information. So you can see this is a couple of counties in Nebraska that actually have each one of the colors represents a different surface water canal that is actually delivering water. And then you're going to see some parcels that just seemed outlined with some hash marks. The hash marked parcels are groundwater only, so their source of water is only through irrigation wells that are drilled into the aquifer. And in this area, you know, the aquifer is 100 to 300 feet deep, depending upon where you are in this area. The colored parcels may have associated groundwater wells that are mostly alluvial, and those would be wells that are less than 100 feet deep and are directly connected to the North Platte River that's running through this area. We also have in this area each one of the surface canals that irrigate that, and you can kind of see that in the top of this picture based upon the difference between the blue and the brown. And the brown is another surface water canal that is kind of nestled in below the blue. And the canals on all of these usually is at the top or the furthest point away from the river. If you're going south, you can also do that too. And that's how you distinguish where the canals actually lie, just as a quick reference. Here's another map, and this is of a different county further down. And you can see that there is still those canal separations in there. But this also shows that there's large concentrations of groundwater-only acres that are solely reliant upon development and use of groundwater wells that don't have surface water that's diverted off the North Platte River. This is a picture where it is predominantly groundwater-only, and this is where our study really comes in, is we're looking at managing this groundwater system and how those declines over time are being measured. We use various methods to attribute parcels with cropping information. The cropping information in the latter years was used as the cropscape information from the USDA NAS data. Cropscape is an attempt to recognize crops from Landsat information. The challenge with using Cropscape in this approach is that some of the more unique crops to the panhandle of Nebraska were not readily recognized, and they were in fact miscategorized. So many times we would have to go back in and reanalyze that data based upon ground truthing information that we came up with. That is especially true of dry beans, which are not soybeans in this area. They're actually pinto beans, most typically, and also sugar beets that is predominant in this area. Those two Cropscape did a very poor job of recognizing up until about 2012, when apparently our complaints were finally heard. Cropping pre-1997, we used National Ag Statistics Service countywide data, and then we narrowed that down based upon what crop types they called irrigated versus non-irrigated. It didn't make a lot of sense to attribute parcels that actually call a good chunk of them winter wheat when we know that is a predominantly dryland crop. And so we would parse the National Ag Statistics data down to irrigated, non-irrigated, and then use our information of what we had as irrigated to assign a crop mix. this is what it looks like when we finally got it built out. As you can see, the red is all of the irrigated parcels that we have. This is a 2010 snapshot again. And then the yellow is all of the dry land that we had identified. Dry land in this case predominantly was wheat fallow. If you were here for Dr. Hansen's talk of rotational fallowing, this is an area directly north of where one of his research plots was. And that's the primary system they use, is either a wheat fallow or a wheat sunflower fallow kind of system. And so we replicated that system through here. We used CropScape to kind of tell us how that rotation works and the relative amounts of acres that go onto each one of those. The annual crop statistics for 1997 through 2013 is what we know the best, because we have good snapshot years, and the NRD started collecting their own information. And so you can see the predominant crops in this area are alfalfa and corn, with well over about two-thirds of the cropping acres being those two high-use crops. And then you see dry beans and grass pasture, and this is kind of interesting. The grass pasture is, in this case, is actually irrigated grass pasture that they're irrigating for livestock production, and typically they'll harvest and bale it off as another income. And then sugar beets across the top that we always had a little bit of difficulties with. The land use irrigation efficiency was something that we spent a great time looking at. One of the things that we have is pumping data from each one of the wells in the system. So the pumping data is typically recorded through continuous flow meters that would record anything from acre inches to acre feet and gallons and all of those kinds of things, and we would have a end of the year reading of how much water each one of those wells produced. We would get all of that information in and put it into a database, and then we would try to assign it some kind of irrigation efficiency. The reason for the irrigation efficiency is we know the crops can't consume 100%, but we also know that we don't have good enough individual parcel data to come up with a reliable estimate parcel by parcel. So what we ended up doing was doing a irrigation efficiency that was sometimes, for sprinkler, 75 to 85%, and I'll show you the variability in a second here. For flood irrigation, it was assigned 55 to 65%. The gains through time is typically what we would replicate, and that was based upon farmers getting better at flood irrigation, for instance, and changing their practices, going to more gated pipe, less dirt ditches and siphon irrigation, and more towards methods that would increase their efficiency. They also, some of these guys went to surge irrigation and other techniques more later on that have been upping their irrigation efficiency each time. Sprinkler irrigation efficiency has had similar effects in that it started with impact nozzles above the pipe. Now it's into drop nozzles and lower pressures and things of that nature. This is kind of how we tracked irrigation efficiency over time. The line variability in here is based upon the crop types and our kind of assumptions of how this worked. But you can see the general trends of groundwater getting much more efficient, mostly due to groundwater being predominantly sprinkler irrigated. Groundwater is such a more precious resource in Nebraska that those guys are getting more efficient with it much more quickly. It takes energy to get it out of the ground. It takes energy to apply it across the field. So they want to be as efficient as possible and use as little as possible. The other thing that is important to note is that groundwater is also the most highly regulated amount of water that's actually been in Nebraska. And so that's having a driver of the individual farmers are getting more efficient just from an economic standpoint and a regulatory standpoint. The surface water, as you can see, has continued to basically stay fairly stable, though we have seen recently, after this 2013, we're working on an update through 17, where we have seen a fairly sharp increase in that efficiency that's mostly due to the adoption of center pivot irrigation, even for surface water, where they're building head stabilization ponds and pumping the water then into their sprinklers to allow them to irrigate a little bit more efficiently with their surface water and cover more ground, which is also something that they have been lacking, especially in drought years. One of the interesting things to note is that both in about 2002, it was a very severe drought up there, and then again in 2007. And you can see that the surface water got significantly more efficient in those 2 years, with peaks in both of those years, trying to stretch that water for as far as they possibly could. From a surface water standpoint, we defined each surface water canal that diverted from the North Platte River, and then we distributed that water to the parcels based upon their crop demand. We don't have direct measurements of what was going on to each field. We basically have some pretty rudimentary information when it comes to these surface water systems. Now, the records go all the way back to the early 1900s, so we have long-term records of what they diverted off the river, but we have very little record of then how that water is dispersed by crop. The only thing really logical to do is a couple of different methods. One of them you can do, which is what we adopted, which was basically looking at the crop demand and filling that with the water that's on there. You could also look at the percentage of ownership of each one of the canal. Most of the time they're divided upon a share acre basis and deliver water that way. It made more sense in this case to deliver it by crop demand. This modeling also created the return flows from those canal operations, which are actually what drives the alluvial system in Nebraska. Those canal losses can be significant. From 50 to 60% of the water is lost after it is diverted back to the aquifer. So it fills up a significant amount of the aquifer and maintains most of the well pumping. The on-farm field recharge that they're seeing from deep percolation is very insignificant compared to what the canal actually loses from its operation. The simulated canal diversions that we didn't have data, we basically backed into from river gauge diversions and administrative conditions, basically calls and administration of the river system and the gauges. We can come up with some assumptions of what their diversions are. There are not many that are not metered at this point, but back in time into the 1950s, we had to synthesize a few. This is a look at the surface water canals that I was just talking about. This is their certified area that they are legally entitled to irrigate. You can see that there are several big canals in here, and then a myriad of small canals that only irrigate a few hundred acres to several that are tens of thousands in acres. Those small canals, there are 22 of them represented in the model. They all divert water from the North Platte River, and they have the legal surface area that we replicated. We did find some instances where they were irrigating either outside of those legal surface areas or that they were associated with the wrong parcels. And we attempted to correct that in cooperation with the NRDs that we were working with. Again, the losses are not only the recharge, but also some into surface runoff, because there is several of these canals that actually return water directly back to the North Platte River if they don't use it as a surplus. The surface water operations model that we use to recreate the surface water conditions, we have the diversions, but we wanted to know more along the lines of how those individual companies operated. So we used a linked node model to represent the surface water system. That model uses the prior appropriation system to simulate the administration, and it also did H on the diversion points. The application and return flows then move the water downstream for the next available canal to pick up. It allows us to do some predictive analysis when we're doing these large-scale changes in terms of either changing to different crop types, changing to different irrigation practices. This allows us not only to see what the groundwater declines are, but also to take a look at what the river administration will do over time as well. And that's a little hard to read, but each one of those is a straight line diagram of the river down the middle of the the large blue line there is the North Platte River, and then each one of the nodes and then subsequent lines coming off is a canal that is diverting. And you can see some of these canals, and then the other blue lines that are actually coming in are tributary streams to the river as well. And you can see that many of these canals that are in the brown are taking off from the North Platte River, diverting water. They also pick up water on these tributaries and deliver them to their various farm certificated acres. This particular diagram is from the Wyoming-Nebraska state line on the North Platte River down, and this the arrow would be pointing to McConaughey Reservoir for just a frame of reference. This is then from that arrow point down further, where you can see other water rights that are also on here. And you can see that each one of the water rights has a specific date associated, which is the prior appropriation system. For instance, the Belmont Canal that is on the bottom part of this screen has a water right date of December 19th of 1889 for 90.22 CFS of water cubic feet per second. And so those water rights are enforced under priority dates. And so if you look at like the another one a little bit further down called Beer Line, that water right has a date of October 13th, 1894 for 14 CFS. And as an example, if Beer Line is not able to get all 14 CFS of water they have rights to, they have the right to call the state administration officials, and they will call up Belmont and have them turn their water rights down and take less water until Beer Line is satisfied with their 14 CFS that they are actually requiring. This happens all summer long. These water rights shift up and down the stream, and you can see how that would have an effect on water use, water efficiency, crop planting, and all of those kinds of things. McConaughey, which is a little bit small in this diagram, I mean that reservoir itself is 1.5 million acre feet. To also represent the area, we broke everything into land use zones. This is basically divided upon canals and unit response functions for lag timing back to the river. And so these are all the big the unit response functions. As you see, as we get closer to the river, we start to break it up in a little bit more fine areas. When you get outside of the river, especially out into the big tablelands where there's predominantly rangeland, generalized assumptions are okay to make out there because they were not going to have any irrigation out there, and then their effects are pretty minimal and long-term in the order of 500 years. The linked node simulation model that we used, reservoirs, segments, and locations, this is a quick diagram of what they are. The link carries water between the nodes, so each one of the links here is represented by black dots. The link is the blue stream basically connected in between. The upper end is a gauging station, and the lower end there is a reservoir. And then the green shaded rectangle is a crop. The model will then take water off from one of those nodes, irrigate with it, and then put water back via return flows of either on-farm return flows or canal return flows back to a node. But everything is always situated on a node. The intermediary links are just a way for us to tell the model this node joins to this node. The state model also starts with hydrology that's termed in this case natural flow. The natural flow is the estimate of removing all upstream effects from man and is gauged plus diversions minus return flow and then change in storage, which storage in this case would be in reservoir storage. And so that would give us a zero effect by man, or at least a theoretical zero effect by man, that then would be able to kind of start with this baseline of water. And then we add some of the more physical features to the system, where we add diversion structures, canals, reservoirs, and even wells, where the wells are actually nodes on the system as well. They're just out a little bit further, and then they use a URF to time their effects back to the river. The model limits the operation basically for a number of different parameters, the headgate locations, the wells, the capacities of each one of the canals, storage volumes, all of these different things we can put limitations on. So we go out into the field when we're constructing these models and we come up with either legal capacities of these structures, or we go back and look at where these structures are located for their own physical limitations. We then superimpose the administrative constraints, which is, again, the legal piece, the water rights itself, which was the example I went through a couple of minutes ago. We also have river compacts, where I showed you where the state line compact between Nebraska and Wyoming, there is a restriction of the amount of water that must flow across that state line in certain times of the year in volume. So we're able to take our model and force it to operate that as a water right on the stream, we're also able to replicate reservoir operations. Upstream from this model, there are several bureau projects that provide about 5 million acre-feet of storage in Wyoming that provide a good deal of the surface water irrigation in this area. Stamont also has two pumping approaches built in, and as I said, we represent wells in this. And to simulate that pumping, we basically have a couple of different approaches that we can use. The approach is built into a surface water structure, because remember, we're predicting commingled pumping. We're not predicting groundwater-only pumping. That's done in a completely separate model because it's kind of that one variable approach. You just have how much water are they going to pump. In this instance, you have both surface water mingling with this parcel that also has another supply, i.e. the groundwater. And so we must have a couple of different approaches to take a look at this. The first approach is called mutual ditch approach, and that quantifies the surface water being applied evenly throughout all the surface water only lands, and then the groundwater is pumped to meet the remaining net irrigation requirement, NIR demands. The second approach is called maximum supply, and that surface water is evenly divided amongst all surface water only lands and then to commingled lands. What this has an effect of doing is it uses more of the surface water on all of the lands and has less of it available for these commingled parcels, which then goes ahead and the groundwater is pumped to meet any commingled flood irrigation demands first. And flood irrigation demands a lot of pumping. Now, it's not a lot of consumption because the efficiency is typically a lot less in the irrigation practice, but it demands a lot of pumping. And pumping is what drives our modflow model itself. The groundwater is then pumped to meet NIR on sprinkler irrigated lands, which is our most efficient water use. To give you a little bit of an example of this and put it into something that makes more sense, these are two of the major canals in the area that actually have pumping. The blue bar in those two circles is what we've actually measured for pumping in 2013. And you can see for the Farmers Canal, which is the first one there, basically, we measured about 15,000 acre-feet of pumping over their system. That was measured with flow meters. We know that to be the number. When we used the mutual ditch approach, the model predicted that that the producer should only have put about 8,000 acre-feet of pumping on. When we used the maximum supply approach, it predicted that they should have put about 30,000 acre-feet on. We then tried to reduce this down a little bit to get these to converge somewhat. And so we reduced 10% of NIR, and we got it under 30,000, but it still wasn't really close to what we were looking at. The other canal, the Pathfinder Canal, is much in a similar situation where we measured roughly 20,000 acre-feet of pumping. And under maximum supply, we could have put on almost 55,000 acre-feet of pumping. And so we had some problems matching what the farmers were actually doing compared to what the measured data shows us. If we eliminated those two big ones out there, and that can allow us to adjust our scale on this graph a little bit, this was all the remaining canals. And you can see that even some of the other canals that are circled in these ovals here have similar issues where the measured pumping was significantly either less or significantly out of whack with what it was. The interesting one is the Mitchell Canal, which is the last oval there, where the measured pumping was almost 5,000 acre feet. Yet what the model predicted under mutual was they should have only really been required to put on about 1,500 acre feet of pumping. And so we had some work to do in both directions, limiting and increasing. The hydrologic data set shows this is actual annual diversions of all of those canals going through time. And so this annual diversion shows how much surface water that is actually in the system for diversion, and then we would apply this water to the fields with an irrigation efficiency and then use it for consumptive use. This shows that we're on the average about 1.2 million acre-feet of water that is used for irrigation in our study area. The regionalized soil water balance model that we use is called CropSim, or a part of it is called CropSim. CropSim was developed at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. It's a soil water balance method that uses the Penman equation and derivatives thereof to create the ET requirements. It also uses weather station information, our land use data, our soil types, and our irrigated lands. The model was originally built as a parcel model. However, we have adapted it to be this regional model itself. This regional model provides groundwater only land pumping that is the pre-metered estimates of how much pumping was happening on these parcels. It also provides groundwater only recharge and irrigation inefficiency information, and so this is what actually goes back into the ground over time. It also provides the other part of the regional soil balance model is a watershed runoff model that actually gives us the irrigation and precip runoff over time that then adds to our river flows. One of the things that we do use a lot of is the weather station information, and so this is a picture of what weather stations we use. They're highlighted in yellow, and then our annual precip distribution across our study period. You can see in this area we're around the 15 to 17 inches of precip a year, and so that's what we would typically find. Though we have seen precip as low as 6 and as high as 25. Soil classifications. We also greatly simplified the soil classifications to 3, mostly because the model has a very hard time with soils, not because it's hard to process, but because of the processing time. We found that when we could group these soils by very similar conditions, we really didn't see in our sensitivity analysis a lot of variation between them. We also have runoff zones, and these runoff zones were created to simulate, if they're in this runoff zone, where on the river this runoff actually enters, and then how it affects the next downstream diversion system. One of the other estimates that we're given is annual rangeland recharge. The rangeland recharge itself is a component where we are looking at across the basin how much recharge we get from rangeland. To do that, we simulated rangeland and in those soil types using all of the weather information, and then basically tried to figure out generally how much precip made it into the aquifer to kind of build the aquifer that we're really talking about here. That precip is a very important component, and we had to adjust quite a few iterations of this to make it work. And being that this model is partially integrated, we would see changes in this precip make drastic changes in our groundwater levels depending upon how we did it. So we ended up adjusting the precip so that we were able to better match our groundwater levels over the long term. This is kind of our last hydrologic data set that we have that was based upon all the data from all of these models. The large blue on this bar graph, this is a stacked bar graph, so the large blue is the surface water consumptive use, meaning the water that is consumed by the crops in the system and that isn't returned as recharge through this system. It averages about 350,000 acre-feet annually. We have groundwater consumptive use that is much smaller. It averages, and you can see it move through time. It became a lot bigger in the 90s and 2000s, mostly because in the 90s and 2000s was when a lot more wells were developed. They were installed, they were put in, they were started to use. A lot of this ground actually became under production at that point in time. And then you can see that we also even have changes in soil moisture here where that storage, we're tracking that storage over time. Give us kind of this final consumptive use number that has hovered around 550,000 acre feet, and spikes in various years depending upon precip conditions to, you know, almost 800,000. From a groundwater perspective, this is our groundwater pumping, which closely correlates to that consumptive use number. And as you can see, in 1953, we only really had about 100 wells, and over time, we have developed to several thousand. And now that groundwater pumping has increased greatly to, you know, well over 200,000 on average. Though you can see in 2008, 9, 10, 11, 12, or 8, 9, and 10, that number really dropped significantly. That wasn't because of a farming practice change, that was because of administration. The administration actually came through and said, you are over-pumping these wells and we must control that pumping in a certain way. And so they allocated that each one of these farmers only got basically 14 inches per acre that they could apply in any one season. And so that is a regulatory effect, not a management effect. Well, I guess it's kind of a management effect too. From a Montflow standpoint, this groundwater modeling, we used 40-acre cell sizes, and we had 177,000 cells. We have the same time period, and we used monthly stress periods. We had about 875 head calibration targets that we were trying to hit, mostly within the NRDs. This is the general geology around the area. As you can see, we have alluvial geology following each one of the rivers, and then some of the outer geology becomes fairly standard. This was the data set information, which was quite interesting. When we commissioned this study, they used radio telemetry to do cross-sectional analysis of the basically of the main alluvial aquifer in red there, trying to give us some better information about what the aquifer looked like. We also then, in the southern part of this study, they used horizontal sweeps to take a look at what the what some of the old alluvial channels look like through there. All of the dots are typically oil and gas wells that we have some information from doing that, and we're now upping this data process, and we're processing about another 700,000 oil and gas wells that are in the area that have yet to be digitized. We're digitizing each one of those, and we're creating a much better alluvial map of base of aquifer for our models here. Looking at some of the pre-development water level maps, this is what it is. Fairly standard, what you would expect. Our model also produces a groundwater flow. So we were looking at, and this is all pre-development, meaning pre-wells. This is how the flow was working when it was just a predominant surface water system. This is the most interesting, which is saturated thickness. And saturated thickness, just to define it real quick, is the area that is saturated from base of aquifer up to some point that is extractable water that we can get for our wells. The blue area to the east is a huge amount of saturated thickness. That's actually a very, very sandy, hilly area that actually is not typically farmed, but is very, very wet. And then you can see in some of our other areas, our saturated thickness is less, and the wells pretty much follow those patterns pretty well. We did have some evapotranspiration areas in the Modflow model itself, mostly because Modflow was fairly easy to add in these areas that were where groundwater levels are fairly high. We could just directly take some ET off of these areas, mostly wetland areas, and as you can see where that giant saturated thickness area is, that's where we also had some ET issues. Our aquifer properties for looking at hydraulic conductivity are right here. We're looking at, you know, some fairly high conductivities in the alluvial areas, as you would expect, 150,000, and then way down lower as we got away from the alluvial channels. For groundwater calibration, these were our calibration targets. So the green line here is the simulated, what our models predicted. The black lines are actually what we observed, and we had 800 of these, and so I just picked a couple of them. I decided we weren't going to do all 800 today. And so we ended up following the trends fairly well. In this kind of modeling, especially at this regional scale, closing the gap isn't as important as in following the trends pretty closely. And as you can see, our trends were almost spot on in most instances here, and we continued to close the gap more and more on a lot of these. And you also have to remember that scale is 10 feet between the lines, so we're off by a foot or two. You're not going to get much better than that. We were, like in this one, we weren't seeing these indescribable drops that they were taking, and we actually think that was some modeling error. This was just one of those interesting ones where we're thinking we saw that. CropSim also required some calibration after we took a look at the groundwater model, because we were seeing some of these head targets not match up. And so we did a quick look at what CropSim was predicting from an evapotranspiration component versus some metered pumping data. And we basically picked on areas where we had only one single crop to eliminate any of this crop mixing where you wouldn't know crop timing and irrigation. So we tried to find parcels that were predominantly one crop. Alfalfa or corn was most of ours, but we found all kinds of them. And so we started looking through, looking at metered consumptive use versus modeled consumptive use. And so our metered consumptive use would be the light blue lines here, or light blue bars, that was for corn in this case. And this was based upon the metering data of the well on this one spot, and this is acre inches per acre which is how they measure everything, versus model corn consumptive use. And you it shows here a very, very good correlation. And so we didn't have any issues with corn. However, alfalfa, we've started to see some pretty big divergence. And this is what we see, which the numbers were actually fairly low when we started looking at what their actual application rates were to what the modeled analysis was. And so we decided that we could do a little bit of refinement here and try to drop some of those consumptive numbers back down. One of the reasons we didn't drop them all the way down to just so that we matched our modeled, our metered information was because we only have 5 years worth of good modeling data that shows us this information. The other one is that we believe that many of these instances may be deficit irrigating their alfalfa where they're not meeting full crop water needs. And so this would push the irrigation efficiency way higher, which could move our consumptive use numbers up, and or they're just sacrificing tons for a little less water and also saving some back. Small grains, we started seeing very similar trends. The first 2 years matched pretty well. We weren't all that concerned. In 11-12, we had some more extreme environmental events where it was drought times. And so we think a similar thing was occurring with those guys where they were deficit irrigating their crops because they were not quite as they were trying to be more efficient and save some of their water for later on in the season. So we adjusted them back a little bit as well, basically a 20% reduction off of what they were. And that got us alfalfa, small grains, and grass pasture was another one that I didn't add in here. I keep talking about our models being partially integrated and that calibration, and this is kind of some of the steps we took. So in CropSim, we could calibrate anything from the soil water balance using irrigation efficiency, groundwater only pumping, precip, etc. StateMod, we could also adjust some of the irrigation efficiencies, the return flows, and the water deliveries, because that was actually delivering water that CropSim was using. And in MODFLOW, we can adjust our hydraulic conductivity, stream parameters, and base of aquifer. So we, in our calibration, went around this loop several times trying to tighten up each one of the tolerances and get our final head targets in the groundwater model to match as best we could, and also getting CropSim to match the meter data that we had. So after all of that, we basically started creating aquifer life analyses after we approached our calibration targets and got satisfied. Our primary objective with an aquifer life analysis was to provide the two NRDs with what drawdown and saturated thickness of the aquifer will look like. And then we wanted to facilitate discussion amongst the boards and public about what this actually was. So we looked at recharge from precipitation, and we also looked at the that this is basically an aquifer mining operation. Aquifer mining is, in our view, basically just extracting the water and figuring out what the life of this aquifer actually is, because we're really not going to see enough long-term recharge to sustain this, so we're just mining the aquifer and managing those declines. So the time frame that these decision makers need to do that is what they were really looking for us and to see, you know, are we and what are we planning on, what are we looking at? One of their major considerations was, you know, what about household wells? I mean, their domestic water supply is paramount to them. So if they're going to be looking at some of these deeper aquifer areas that have house wells in there, when would they start to be affected? Because that ultimately will drive people completely out of their communities. There are some points, and we categorize these in the analysis, where they would no longer be able to sustain high-capacity irrigation, and then some low-capacity at some certain point. Basically, we used a rule of thumb about two-thirds of the saturated thickness was depleted, and then they would have to either upgrade their irrigation well equipment, or they would have to do some other, change their level of pumping, redrill their well. We do know that the deepest wells in the area would be able to produce the longest. So we created a bunch of scenarios that that was in collaboration with the boards and other entities, and basically looking at wet, dry, and average conditions. And then we were repeating 2009 to 2013. The reason that we were repeating those years was because that is the time period at which we had pumping meter data. So we have good data that we were confident in. So if we repeated that into the future, it would be something believable. Also, during that time, there were some restrictions on pumping, meaning that they were just not pumping wild amounts of water, that it had some regulatory control. So we had some certainty that they weren't too out of whack. We also created a few pumping scenarios where we decided, okay, let's just turn off all pumping. Let's put on 16 acre inches per acre, 14 And those two numbers are significant because that's where their allocation. 16 was where they were initially. They dropped them down to 14 to try to manage the aquifer declines a little bit better. And they've talked about 12 and 10 as potential ones to go to that maybe will sustain the aquifer more long term. And so we modeled each one of those, and then we also, again, repeated 9 through 13. The areas that we were focusing on are basically two big areas. This northern tablelands aquifer, this is predominantly gets all of its water from the Ogallala aquifer. It doesn't get any of its water from the alluvial system that we also model in this same area. These are where we're seeing the big aquifer declines from the Ogallala. The other one is the south tablelands aquifer that is also an alluvial channel of the Ogallala, but it doesn't have the alluvial fan like the northern area does. So we used the initial heads from April of 2014. We ran a 500-year simulation, which, yeah, it was a bit ridiculous, but we wanted to see some extreme numbers just to kind of point them to where they were going to go. And then we used annual stress periods because when you're running out this long, nobody really cares about monthly data. We repeated the 09 through 13 pumping and recharge through the entire simulation, and then we used some Wyoming information to take a look at the their pumping from across the state line because there's these state line effects that have this. Our results were basically drawdown and percent saturated thickness. So in the south tablelands, this is the effect. As you can see, there is some 75-foot drawdowns in this at some in the initial 25-year run. At 50 years, you can see it start to spread to 50-foot drawdowns. At 100 and then 500 years, you're seeing 150-foot drawdowns in these certain areas, and it kind of bullseyes this area. It follows pretty well because that's where the majority of the irrigation is, and you can just make out the little circles and squares in there that are the majority of the irrigation, and so this is where it is. But we decided that that wasn't exactly accurate. Just because it draws down a lot doesn't actually mean it's not usable. All it means is it drew down a lot. And we're looking at aquifer life, we're actually more concerned about saturated thickness. And so this is the same information, but just using a percent saturated thickness drawdown. And so in this same area, you're seeing 75% of the saturated thickness drawdown in 50 years right away in some of these areas. And then at 500 years, you're seeing 75% and 50% amongst the whole thing, the whole entire area, which to us would mean that most of this irrigation would not be feasible at that point because at a 50% drawdown, or a 50% saturated thickness, you would be radically changing your irrigation wells and such. And so this was where we ended up taking the most information and most informed decisions on. North Platte was very similar to that, where we were seeing these drawdowns at 25 years. We were seeing 25-foot drawdowns, and then we were seeing 50-foot drawdowns, and then some into the 100-foot drawdowns that were kind of all of the same area. But that, again, didn't tell us a great story. When we finally got to the saturated thickness drawdowns, that was when we started seeing this, because already in the area that only had a very minimal drawdown, we see that that's actually 25 to 50 and then into 75% of their saturated thickness, which would have meant that irrigation would have stopped in those areas. Yet the groundwater declines were not as significant as what you would think. And so this actually provides a much better map, a much better way to look at what these declines look like over time and where the areas of most critical impact are. As I mentioned briefly, the Upper Niobrara White NRD, which I haven't talked about a lot, uses the very similar concept of model and also hired us to do some similar situations. I threw this in here because it has some very interesting data that is along the same lines. Modeling is very similar to what we had done with the other one. It's a little bit more simplified because their system is a little more simplified. You can see their area is just north of where we were, and they wanted to understand how long their groundwater will last. They had, this is a very controversial area in terms of groundwater restrictions and how much aquifer they have. They wanted a plan and some predictive analysis on what they should be expecting. This one we didn't run for 500 years because the drawdowns were so significant after 100, we had no reason to go on beyond that. So we used, and this one we also used monthly stress periods because they wanted a little bit more fine look at this. We repeated 2006 through 2010 pumping because that was when their measurement time periods was, and we used December 2010 modeled water levels as our starting points. Their drawdown is very interesting because this was kind of their initial. After 20 years, you're seeing 20 to 50 feet. Then this one has a very cool bullseye effect where it's just in the center where all of the irrigation is where you're seeing it. And you're seeing drawdown at 100 years at more than 110 feet, which is a huge amount of drawdown if they maintain the pumping that they've been doing over the last 5 years. The more important story is saturated thickness at this, and you're seeing a 10% drawdown at 10 years, 40% drawdown in 20 years. At 60 years, you're seeing somewhere upwards of 50 and 75% drawdown in these areas. And so we would see that the vast majority of this pumping kind of in their bullseye would stop, which unfortunately for them is the most rich farming lands in this area. And so we will see a massive restructuring of their economy over time because they will literally mine this aquifer dry. It's not recharging at a rate sustainable. And this is the largest chunk of their irrigation in the area. So they are going to do some more radical changes to try to stem the tide. Though there is this feeling that, well, it's theirs. Why don't they just they mine it for as long as they can, and then they'll try to do something else. So one of the interesting things we did was we basically posed some questions, and these are good things just to think about when we're doing these kinds of analysis, and that is how far in the future do we plan? I mean, you know, declines, are we looking at 10 years, 25? I know the last presentation said they were looking at 50 years, you know, those kinds of things. Do we look at 100? Because at 100 in a certain area, you may see a complete zeroing of the pumping, whereas are we just looking at 10 years? And also for saturated thickness, you know, what percentage of saturated thickness are we going to manage to? You know, is that 25%? Is it 50%? Is it 75%? And so very interesting kind of thoughts to provoke. And once you give people this background, they start to go, oh, yeah, maybe we should actually think about where we go into the future and how we start looking at these forecasts that are a little bit more near term than what they've actually thought. So with that, that's my presentation. I would be happy to entertain any questions. They're kind of running in complement to each other because as the aquifer declines and the pumping water, they have to get more efficient. And so as they get more efficient, they can use less water. So hopefully that would actually translate into less pumping of the groundwater and less mining and therefore a longer term impact. We've actually looked at changing a majority of the system over to, say, drip irrigation that would have a 95% efficient use of the water. You always have to remember, if I'm going to use 95% as efficient, my pumping rate is going to be cut by probably two-thirds at that point in time because these flood irrigation parcels that are only 50% efficient are pumping at a rate of, you know, several thousand gallons per minute. And therefore, if you go to a very high efficiency irrigation practice, say drip irrigation, you can go from 2,000 gallons a minute well to a 600 gallon a minute well and cover the exact same area. And so for potatoes, for instance, which there's some potato farming up there, they would be interested, especially high value crops like that, into going to this because it's going to help them have the maximum amount of water because right now the management that these districts are doing is based upon raw pumping. So if you can most efficiently use the amount of pump water you can get out of the well, that is most beneficial to you. So if you can consume all of it, and put it all towards crop production, that's actually the most benefit. So hopefully those two actually continue to, the irrigation efficiency continues to drive down the pumping volumes over time, and therefore we would extend the longevity of the aquifers.
A follow-up question is, when you simulate that
Yeah, absolutely. We actually, we can see that the groundwater pumping goes down when you up the efficiency. Our models actually know that, that you can more efficiently use that. And it's basically, it back calculates. So it says, okay, if the water needs, or if the crop needs 100 and the efficiency is now, it was 50, then it's going to need 150. But if the efficiency is now 80, it's only, or, you know, if the efficiency is 85, it's only going to need about 120. And so it actually is decreasing that pumping as efficiency goes up. And we run scenario analysis trying to take a look at incentivizing farmers to up their irrigation efficiencies via economic programs so that we can sustain more aquifer life in these areas. And so we can run scenario analysis basically on these 95% efficiency programs.